This podcast is intended for investment professionals.
Hello and welcome to Elgin Talks. I'm Max Julius. I'm delighted to be joined by Fadi Zaher, our Head of Index Research and Development, to discuss his new book, Index Fund Management, A Practical Guide to Smart Beta, Factor Investing and Risk Premia. Fadi, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Max. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you here for your first outing.
Yes.
Well, first of all, for the uninitiated, how do you define factor investing?
Okay, there's different ways of thinking about it, and it depends who you talk to. But the simplest way to start to think about it is that factor investing is a collection of investment styles, really. And for anything to qualify as a factor, it needs to have an economic or logical meaning. And another part is that it has been persistent and consistent in terms of performance over a longer term. And that performance is more in relation to the traditional market, how it's done in relation to the so-called market capitalization index. But if you take one step down...
That's like your S&P 500, say.
That's it, exactly, right. Or FTSE 100.
Yeah.
And you look at what the drivers of these factors are. There are often three explanations to it. And the first one is really about you getting reward for the risk that you're taking. So if you're investing in a value factor, you're getting rewarded for investing in that risk and that factor. And the other is the behavioral drivers of the underlying markets. And this behavior creates so-called factor premia or returns in above, over and beyond that traditional market index. And take, for example, when markets are tanking, a lot of investors tend to shy away from the market. They don't even participate in the market, or they avoid certain stocks because we tend to project the present into the future. We think that markets will continue to fall for a longer period of time. And value investor typically comes in there and kind of embark on these opportunities and create a strategy around these stocks. And then you have the market structures. And the market structures is generally about how markets are organized. And one good example would be like smaller companies tends to have very little coverage or little attention from analysts and general investors compared to the larger stocks. So in the book, I think I show some statistics where the largest stocks in the world tend to have an average about 27 analysts covering them on a daily basis compared to a smaller stock that is about 8. So you can see that difference. And it used to be even smaller. That 8 used to be in like 1 or 2 many years ago, but it's kind of improving. But that's kind of a market structure. So that's kind of how you can strike that journey. But there's one very nice example that's kind of attributed to two prominent academics, John Cochrane and Andrew Ng. And they kind of look at, and I draw that in the book, in the first chapter, where I show like that factors are like nutrients. If you take, for example, when you eat chicken, Max, you might have a lot of nutrients, but a lot of the primary nutrients are you get effectively proteins, and then you get a lot of vitamins with it. And that's kind of when you invest in a factor, you kind of getting the nutrients there would be like the quality characteristics or the value characteristics or any other characteristics. And if you take a tangible example around that, it's like Warren Buffett. Typically, when you do invest with Warren Buffett, you're effectively getting some kind of quality value type of characteristics, this kind of the nutrients you're getting,
right.
The primary nutrients. And if you invest in technology stocks, you affect the nutrients there or the characteristics are, that's like momentum. You get typically momentum. That's how I think about it.
So together they make up a portfolio and a meal.
That's exactly very good. Right, you got it. I'm glad you followed me through that.
You know,
excellent.
I did. And actually, let's talk of food is making me hungry.
Oh. But,
it's a really fascinating piece of work, and I think much needed in the industry, given some confusion over the terms you discuss. What led you to write it, and who is it aimed at?
So the top, I mean, smart beta factor investing, it's really an umbrella term. And there are so many things that can fit inside that umbrella, beneath that umbrella. And we work for Elgin, it's actually a symbol as an umbrella. So and starting to think about it, when I started, and I've worked in the topic for a number of years, And when I look at it, like over the last years, I found it very fragmented. It's very well written in some areas here and there, but it's really fragmented. And I wanted to really write something that draws all of this together and really put together what is actually really matters when it comes to factor investing, like what factors really matters. But also I found that the topic sometimes can be inaccessible to investors who might not have the sophistication or a deep knowledge about factor investing and don't know exactly what it is. And sometimes I found that the topic, there's unnecessary complexity that is imposed on the topic that it doesn't deserve. So what I'm trying to do with the book is to actually make it accessible to trustees, investors, and even students, people who want just to learn about this different style investing and then possibly use it in a practical way. And that's one of the reasons I decided to put together all of this. And then the other important message I want, and a reason why I wrote the book, is that I wanted to call out or make people aware of the fanatics of factor investing, those who think that that's the only thing you should be doing in your life. And I also wanted to draw attention to those that think that it's doomed and you shouldn't be doing it because this is all an illusion. And that's also obviously not the case either, because this investment style has been there for decades and decades. So really, I wanted to bring these questions and attention to these questions and provide some answers to them.
That's great. And could you tell us a little bit about the ground you cover in the book?
Yes. So the book starts with this kind of questions. It kind of calls out the fanatics and the skeptics of that. And it's trying to kind of draw attention to that. You should look at it with an open mind. Different needs, different investors, and it can fit in different portfolio in different way. So the first chapter really draw attention to this, and then it continues into kind of describing the evolution of factor investing, where it started and where we are today, and walk the readers through that journey. And the second part of the book, that's really when I say these are the five factors within equity that matters. We're talking about value, quality, momentum, low risk factor, and then size factor, which is like mid-sized, small caps stocks. And really discuss this investment style, these factors, and what drives them and how to think about them and even how to construct them. And then I move into the third part of the book where I start to look at other things than equities, because most people, when they think about smart beta and factor investing, they are associated with equities. But actually, factors exist across all asset classes. So I start with the fixed income, and that's actually how I started factor investing. I started factor investing in fixed income at the time when I was at the European Central Bank, and then at Barclays, and then at Climate, and then through different other financial institutions. But I draw attention to fixed income factors. I outline how to think about them. Some of them are factors, some of them are just styles. And then I conclude with a multi-asset strategies. Some of it's kind of hedge fund strategies that can be systemized, put into an index called alternative risk premia strategies, and look at commodities and currencies. So that's kind of three parts of the book.
Well, that's really interesting and a really comprehensive. I mean, just listening to you now and having read the book, I know there are a number of sections that are likely to prove controversial among the factor community. I mean, you talk about approaches to non-traditional areas such as fixed income, and your selection of what you call true factors, yeah, I think might also raise some eyebrows. Where do you anticipate the most debate or even pushback to your conclusions?
Well, I look at it with an open mind. And of course, different people, maybe some of those fanatics or some of those skeptics might think that I've misrepresented something. But I don't think so. I've tried to be as objective as possible with it and use my practical experience in actually managing assets with this type of strategies over the number of years. And one of the areas that I think has always been debated, but I bring it to light in one of the chapters. I think it's chapter 9. It's in the multi-factor, where effectively which approach to use, a bottom-up or a top-down approach to construct a multi-factor, which is basically a combination of all these different type of factors I mentioned, and which approach is the best one to use. And my conclusion to this is actually both of the type of approaches that you might use will get you to the same answer over a long period of time. What might work in one period might not work in another. But there is no right or wrong answers, although some of them, some advocates out there might be for one or another. So that's one thing. The other thing is the fixed income, as you rightly highlighted, because I think, you know, for example, one of the most controversial factors, I mean, there's not much written in it. There hasn't much been research in that space. And the reason for that is because there is not enough data to go back to really see whether these factors have really persisted. But for example, low volatility or low risk factor in fixed income, it's debated whether it is a factor or not. And one thought about it is that those who think about it as a low, as a factor, low volatility factor in fixed income, it's effectively being on the short end of the yield curve. You end up with shorter dated bonds. That's not necessarily a factor because it's linked to the interest rate cycles. But however, I do show that actually, if you do want a low risk factor, this is kind of how you could do it, by not just being putting yourself in a corner of just being on a short-dated bond. So there are a few controversies. And the same thing with the alternative risk premium. People might argue that actually some of the things that you have presented, they may not be systemized, although actually everything has been backed up with actual examples and systematic approaches to manage this.
Well, that's fascinating. Perhaps we could drill down to a couple of the true factors you mentioned. So I know on quality, you have a colourful sporting analogy within the book. Do you want to talk to us about how you see that factor?
Yes. So the quality factor is, I think everyone wants quality to some extent. And I think it exists in a lot of asset classes. As one example, it's kind of linked to sports. And I think that was inspired by a friend of mine who, Vitaly Kalisnik at the research affiliate, actually, who basically made an association to sports. And I thought that example was a fantastic example for people who are interested in sports. But effectively, if you're familiar with the story Moneyball with Michael Lewis.
A film,
exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you remember the actor?
Brad Pitt, I believe.
That's it. Good. Excellent. So what the concept there was effectively to win as many games as cheaply as possible by Billy Beane, who was responsible for the Oakland Athletics in the 2002 season. And the idea was there to get players as cheaply as possible, but they were quality baseball players. And effectively, they ended up to make a big success. And the way Billy Beane, who was the coach of that team, was basically based it on statistics and found these quality value players. I bring it one step further there when I bring it to, because we're living in England and we love football, and American call it soccer, but I use Alex Ferguson as an example. And Alex Ferguson is exactly a copy of Billy Beane, and actually he precedes Billy Beane because he was very successful with Manchester United for so many years, where he selected quality players that he literally raised up that became a great value for the club, hence the success of that club for decades. I'm not a Manchester United fan, by the way, right. but I do admire success like Alex Ferguson's success in that example linked to factor investing.
Alex Ferguson, the quality factor investor of football managers.
That's it. Oh, maybe. There might be others.
Among others. Now, drilling down to the technical definition of factors. Well, I mean, how important is the specific technical definition, how you define them? Say, for value, should investors look at price to book or price to earnings?
Okay. I think when you construct a global strategy and you look at what the objectives here, I think it's more important to me is to be aware of the drawdowns or the drawbacks, I would say, of the different...
So also methods. Important to be aware of drawdowns.
Drawdowns and drawbacks, yeah. Actually, when you actually develop a factor strategy, you want to understand... Yeah. How far down it can go.
Right.
So that's a very good point. But the drawbacks of the characteristics in the design matters quite a lot. And what you find is that if you actually look at, the top 20 or 10 value factor funds or indices out there in the market, you'll find that they perform differently. And the reason for that is because they have different ingredients. in the construction approach. But you mentioned a price to book. For example, price to book might not work very well for tech companies because price to book doesn't take into account, so it's called intangible assets. And tech companies, when they invest, they don't get that benefit in the way that the book value of that company tends to would not increase. So you will actually look at these companies and they might look quite expensive for you to buy. So that's kind of an example of the price to book. But another example was actually in the global financial crisis, where I say, for example, price to earnings, because banks did not make much earnings. It made these stocks look very, very expensive again. So you didn't actually embark on the recovery of the banking sector and you avoided it completely based on just the price to earning characteristic. So really, depending on what you use, you might get different things. But as long as you know what the limitations are, I think you'll be fine. But it's very important to understand that, I think.
Right. And I mean, and taking a step back from those areas and looking at your book as a contribution into the broader debate about where the investment industry is today, and this, you know, trend from active to index strategies, you write really interestingly about how factor investing sits in that an area in between active and passive in terms of fees, transparency, capacity. You also touch on manager discretion, which leads me to ask, is it possible to time factors?
Okay, so the hardest predictions to do, Max, and I will not lie to you here, it's actually about the future. And as I think,
right. I've heard that.
Yeah, Niels Bohr, who's the Danish physicist, who said that. So I think you can time factor, and that maybe goes back to one of your questions that I probably didn't mention here. But there's another controversy that people might say you can actually not time factor. So that could be obviously a challenge. But I just based it on my own experience, and I describe the approaches you could do it. So you cannot time the market perfectly, but there is a way to do it to some extent. And what I highlight actually in the book is that there are three ways of doing it. The first one is really to understand the valuation and fundamentals of the underlying factors. So you're looking at the valuation of the momentum factor itself. You're looking at the valuation of the value factor itself. So that's kind of one approach to look at it. And the way you do it is that you look at where is that factor trading today compared to its historical norms. So it's a kind of very simple approach that's kind of can be quite effective. It doesn't give you the full returns that you might be expecting, but it gives you some of it if you're doing it properly. That's the first approach that I highlight. Second approach is actually understanding markets, just understanding the sentiments in the markets. And in the beginning, when we defined factors, I gave an example where, for example, when markets are really down, the sentiments, investor sentiment is really rattled. So people are fearing to invest in the markets. But if you actually really have a strong conviction or belief about specific stocks or specific strategy, you can pick up opportunities there. So that's kind of a sentimental factor. Then you have the third approach. There are probably more and more, but the third approach that is the kind of understanding the economic and market cycles. So, for example, if you know, if you have an expectations of where you are on a business cycle, then you'll be able to understand that, okay, in a recovery period, the smaller companies and the momentum factor will do well. And even the value stocks, because the value stocks has been, or stocks has been hammered before, and you pick them up as an opportunity, and in that recovery phase, you will do pretty well. Or when you see the slowdown in the economy, okay, the markets reacts a bit earlier than the economic indicators. But what you see is that you would probably de-risk and go into quality factors or tilt more to the low volatility factors. So yes, you can actually time the market. And I think you can't just do it perfectly, but it is possible. And this is an entire industry out there. And that's kind of falls in within the discretionary. And I do think that you will see more of that. That's one of the biggest areas that I can see happening in the factor investing space.
Very interesting. Well, I mean, seeing as we're talking about the future, where do you see the future of factor investing going?
So I think many did not expect in 2008 that factor investing will be almost now over $1 trillion in assets. And I think, and it's very important to think about that, because the reason why it got to the $1 trillion, over $1 trillion today, and over 1,000 funds in that space, is because of the availability of data, the speed of computing. I remember when I used to do some computations on the computers a few years ago. I mean, it will run for overnight, when the same computation can be done within seconds today. So that kind of advancement in the technology and the data will lead, bring factor investing to a next step, where these rules around the indices will be more relaxed. And one thing we're talking about is the discretionary factor investing, or something we call trigger-based factor investing, or trigger-based indices, where instead of rebalancing every, say, 6 months or every 3 months, you're rebalancing the index based on the rules that could be conditional on the way the market is behaving, or the way a stock is behaving, and so forth. So discretionary factor investing is something that I expect to become bigger, which kind of shouldn't be confused with quant active. Okay. Investing, because it will remain transparent.
Fascinating. Well, finally, I'd just like to ask you to tell us a little about what you do at LGIM, and how all of this thought around factor investing fits into your day job.
My job is to kind of research and develop index strategies, a systematic index strategy, and that's within that remits falls factor investing, and I do also the ESG, some of the ESG funds. And I work also across LGIM with other teams, even within the active space or multi-asset team. So I feel fortunate to have that opportunity to work with the broader investment function within LGIM, but also have the ability to develop these strategies in the way that I think are meaningful, working also with clients to tailor and design investment strategies for them that fits their needs. And help people like you as well, who helped me to actually write it down and communicate it that in a meaningful way. But just before we also finish here, I actually would like to thank some of my colleagues also that have followed me through that journey. And by the way, if you haven't said that, I have known Max for a number of years when he used to be a journalist at Bloomberg. He used to give me a call in the morning asking me about the markets. And most of the recommendation, I'm telling him the truth, were actually coming from these strategies. So when you ask me where a specific bond strategy was cheap or expensive, or an equity strategy, it was always coming from these approaches.
I had no idea.
Well, there you go. Now you know this. And I've saved myself for this. I knew we will meet one day again. So now we are colleagues, obviously, now since he was a journalist. But I actually want to thank colleagues who have followed me through the journey. And one of my greatest colleagues who actually taught me a lot about markets was Kevin Gardner. And also colleagues who followed me over the years and worked with me in different institutions, and also now with me at LGIM, like Wei Yang and Daria Kuzina, and great colleagues who have also helped me to look at the content and shape it up within LGIM, also David Barron and Andre Pioche. And also the marketing team has obviously helped with a lot of the contents. So I'm really grateful for all the help that people have provided over the years.
Brilliant. Thank you, Fadi. You've given us a huge amount to think about today. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. To find out more about Fadi's work, you can read his blog posts and articles on LGIM.com. And watch out for the publication of his book, Index Fund Management, A Practical Guide to Smart Beta, Factor Investing and Risk Premia, coming soon.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.